At this time, I will introduce our speaker for tonight. I come to this group meeting at noon often, and I sit next to the gentleman who is about to speak for us tonight. And what I can tell you is this: I feel safe when I'm near him. Very safe. I learn from him. I am inspired by him. I respect him. And he also makes me laugh my ass off. So I'm very pleased to present G.W. from the
Can't talk without a big one. I'm an alcoholic. My name is G.W. Sober today through the grace of God in AA. My sobriety date's May the 4th, 1977, so if you're trying to figure it out, in this May I'll have 35 years of continuous sobriety. And let me apologize before I start. If I make you uncomfortable, I don't intend to, but this is my story. So, and according to the book, I'm going to tell you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. My family moved to Florida when I was about 6 years old because I kept getting pneumonia during the winter times up there, and I didn't think I'd survive another one. And I came down here, and my father passed away when I was 10 years old. And my mother was one of these people that, he drank himself to death, by the way. And my mother was one of these women that couldn't be alone. So in rapid succession, I went through 7 stepfathers. I only had to be around one of them. But all 7 of them drank themselves to death. And years later, when I was in the program, I thought, I wonder what the common denominator is. And all those things. My mother's toxic. And I recognize that now, and I stay away from her as much as I can. So, every one of them were drinkers. All of them were. About a week before I turned 17, stepfather number one had come home from fishing, and he had broken every window in the house. And he was just in a drunken rage, and he was a nasty son of a bitch. And he was a good moonshiner. That's where I took my first drink out of his still. My first drink was 198 proof White Lightning at the age of 9. And I got drunk, and I blacked out, and I passed out, and I woke up, and I threw up. And the difference between my brother and I is he didn't want no more, and I went back and got another one the next day. And then I learned the neighbors would pay handsomely for it, so I wound up stealing moonshine from my father to sell to the neighbors so I could get money to do what I wanted to do. My father told me he was going to whipped my ass for stealing his moonshine about a week before I turned 17. And the rage that had been building in me since I was 10 when I first met him came out. So I told him to come out in the yard and pack a lunch because this is going to be a full-time job whipping my ass. And he walked out in the front yard, and I had an axe handle, and I took his left knee and I put him on the ground. And I started pounding on him. I gave him 2 black eyes. I dislocated his jaw. I was trying to kill him. Well, the neighbors called the cops. While the cops were en route, my mom came out in the front yard and clocked me in the back of the head with a frying pan so that I'd leave her love alone. So I wound up going to court. He charged me with attempted murder and assault and battery. So I went to court, and if you'd have to live in Lake County. It's up in Leesburg at this time. This is pre-Disney. There's nothing here. I mean, when I grew up in Lake County, 436 dead-ended at 1792, and there was nothing here. Nothing. But cut a deal with the judge. When I went to court, he said I could either go to Willis McCall's Boys Ranch, which was just slave labor, or I could see this gentleman in a white uniform and join the Navy. That was in 1965. And they were taking any warm-bodied people that they could handle to send to Vietnam. So I looked at this guy in a white suit and I said, "You get me out of here?" He said, "I'll get you out of here." I said, "Let's go." And my mother had to sign the papers to let me join the Navy at 17 rather than wait till 18, and she was willing to do that. So I joined the Navy when I was 17, went to boot camp in Great Lakes, still drinking. You know, I don't know how, you know, we're devious people when it comes to drinking. You know, I'm in lockdown in basic training in Great Lakes, and I still found a way. You know, I think I bribed the cook. Anyway, I drank through boot camp. And when I was in boot camp, they gave me a psychological evaluation, and they found out that I didn't have weak morals. I had no morals. And they took me out on a range, and I'd been hunting up in Lake County all my life. I used to shoot squirrels out of trees, and the only way you can get them where they taste good is you have to do something called barking them, and that's when they put their head down on a branch, you hit the branch and it knocks them out and they fall to the ground, and then you can kill them and clean them, and they taste pretty good. That's country stuff. But they took me out on a rifle range and gave me a 22 and put a target about 100 yards away, and I just blew that away. Then they took me out to a regular range and I started hitting targets 150 yards away with a naked eye with no scope. And they said, "We got a job for you." So my first job in the Navy, I went to Adak, Alaska, out on the Aleutian Islands. Way out on the Aleutian Islands. That's where Palin can see Russia from. And they have a Navy base up there. And what had happened over the years, the dependents would come up there and they would bring their pets. And then their pets would escape. And then they would come back home to the lower 48. And they'd leave their dog and their cats up there. And these animals were starting to get really vicious to the people. They started to attack the people up there because there were packs of wild dogs. So I got up to Adak and they gave me a Jeep and an M1 and enough food and told me to go clean it up. So my first official job in the Navy was shooting dogs. Shooting wild dogs. And that took me about 6 months to clean it up. Now they don't allow you to bring pets up there anymore because people don't take care of them. My next job was on a fleet tug. And I was off the coast of Vietnam. And if you've ever seen the movies where you see the troops landing on the beach with the LSTs and the gate falls down and they all run ashore, well, our job, if any of them that got stuck on a beach, we'd go in and tow them off and pull them off so they could get underway again. And that was my first encounter in Vietnam. They wouldn't let me go to Vietnam while I was 17 because they didn't want me to die while I was 17. But the day after I turned 18, they said, "We got a job for you." So I went to SEER training out in California, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape, still drinking. And I went to Vietnam doing psychological warfare operations. And it was insane. I won't even go into it. It was just pure insanity. But while I was over there, I discovered that you could take a pack of Pall Mall cigarettes, sealed, you know, the long ones, and send them out with your laundry to get them done, and when they came back, they'd still be sealed. But when you opened them up, there'd be like a quarter of an inch of tobacco on each end of it, and the rest of it was stuffed with pure dope, the good stuff. And I started smoking marijuana and other things, taking pills, and just having a good time doing what I was doing. I love Vietnam for one reason. I felt comfortable there with the chaos. And I felt comfortable there with the terror because that's what I grew up with. And it didn't bother me. It didn't bother me enough where I stayed for 3 years. Everybody else had a year term and they would cycle out and go home. Not me. I stayed for 3 years. I stayed till they made me leave. And when I got home, I was walking through the airport in San Francisco, and I was in uniform, coming back from Vietnam, and somebody in the airport called me a baby killer and spit on me. Well, I broke his jaw. I was always good at that. So the San Francisco police arrested me for assault, took me to the police station, took me in the front, had a cab waiting in the back with all my stuff in it, put me in a cab and said, get the hell out of Dodge. Because back then, the country didn't agree with what we were doing, and we were not well treated when we got home. So I got out, went back to Leesburg, still pre-Disney, and I got a job at a place called Mercer Plastics, and I did the graveyard shift. If you look around the wall, you'll see this plastic stuff along the wall. They had a big extruder, and all I did for 8 hours was sit there with a micrometer and check the thickness of it. You know, I'm supposed to check like every 2 minutes, 3 minutes, so I got this micrometer. I got a fifth of Jack Daniels in one hand and a micrometer in the other, and I'm just... So if you get thin plastic, you know where it came from. Or thick, doesn't matter. I would change the thickness with a switch, and the plastic would come out like different whisks and stuff, you know. And it was very boring. No action. So the Navy calls me up and says, if you re-enlist for 6 years, we'll give you $10,000 and 30 days to spend it. I went, oh, cool. I'm in. So I got back in. They gave me $10,000 and 30 days to spend it. By the time I checked in, I was broke. I bought everybody a drink. And I went to Norfolk, Virginia. And I went on a aircraft carrier, I think it was the Independence, and went on a cruise in the Independence. My drinking was just outrageous. I was smuggling booze aboard. I was drinking around the clock. I think Diane drank like I did. I don't know if she's here tonight or not. Yeah. But I watched her drink before she got sober, and that was the same way. It was like constant, around the clock drinking. Yeah. And that's the way I drank. And you'd never know that I was drunk, because you build a tolerance for alcohol. If you're new in here, you build up this tolerance where the first time you got drunk, it took you a beer. The last time I got drunk, I was drinking a quart and a half of vodka a day just to maintain. And I was the captain's driver in Italy. And I got in a wreck, and fortunately for me, the guys found me and took me back to the ship, because in Italy, if you get caught drunk driving, they don't send you to jail. They send you to the nut house. They figure you got to be insane to be drinking and driving. So there's no jail. You go straight to the crazy bin. And they'll let you out when they feel like you're not a deterrent to people anymore. But I've always been lucky with my alcohol and my drug addiction. I've always skipped out. When I went into the hospital after being in this car accident, I started to go through DTs. So they sent me to the Naples Hospital for my first treatment center. And I was a medical miracle. They couldn't figure it out. Well, when I was, they told me to go. And they let me go on my own recognizance. You know, like, get off the ship, get a cab, go to this hospital. And you're going to go into a 28-day program. Well, I got there, but before I checked in, I went downstairs to the kitchen, and I cut a deal with the cook that I would lower a basket down from detox every night, and he'd put 3 bottles of wine in it and pull it back up. And they kept trying to take my blood to find out when they could put me on antabuse, and my blood alcohol content never went down. And they didn't find that out for 7 days. You know, something's wrong here, you know. So finally they caught the cook downstairs, and I don't know what they did with him, but they got me and put me through detox. And I went through my first treatment center in Naples. When I was there, 6 weeks is the normal treatment. I was there for 8 months. They gave me antabuse. And they said, now if you drink on antabuse, it could hurt you. So I took this antabuse. I was there for 6 weeks. They says, now you can go into town and see how you act around the public and all this other stuff. I got down at the bottom of the hill of the hospital. There's a bar. So I go in there and order a couple of beers, and I'm sipping this beer, and nothing happens. And I said, I got this shit beat. So I ordered a couple of shots of whiskey, and I woke up in intensive care. My heart stopped, and they kick-started me. You ever heard the word clear? Nasty word. So they got my heart started, put me back up in treatment. Another 6 weeks. I said, okay, we got him up on antabuse. He's not had a drink in 6 weeks. Let's see what he does. So I go out, go back down the hill. And in the back of my mind, it says, it's the whiskey that got you. So I drank six beers. Walked back up intensive care. And the admiral of the hospital came to see me, and he says, if you do this again, would you mind staying in the hospital and doing it and letting us film it? Because we want to make a training flick to show other assholes what it's like to drink on antabuse. So I got out of treatment after 8 months, and I thought, okay, I can't drink, you know, because they were starting to cut the Navy down, and I didn't want to get out. So I switched, and I thought, these guys are talking about shooting speed and downers and heroin and stuff like that. I tried it. One time in my life, I put a needle in my arm, just once. And a year later, I was right back in that same hospital with hepatitis. I got hepatitis A or B or whichever letter it was. I don't know. But I was up in that hospital for another 3 months in a hepatitis ward. But the thing that happened is I had hepatitis B and the guy with me had hepatitis A. And we had the same guy down at the bottom sending us little blocks of hash up because we knew we couldn't drink on hepatitis with hepatitis. So we'd go into the bathroom and smoke. You know, you take the inside of a cigarette pack and you turn it around and you roll it up and you make a nice little pipe out of it. You know, and we're sitting there switching back and forth. Well, this guy leaves. Now I got Hep A and B. So I'm in the hospital again 8 months. My medical record, you don't even want to look at it. You know, I had more sniffles and more colds and downtime than you could imagine. The Navy used to have cough syrup that was 12% alcohol by volume. So I always had a cough. I always had a scratchy throat. I needed, you know, and I go down there and they just give you a bottle of it and you drink it and, like drinking wine. And then they found out that we were abusing the privilege, right? So the Navy figured they would change the formula of the cough syrup they were giving us. Instead of putting 12% by volume alcohol, they put 5% by volume chloroform. That's instant. Half a bottle of that, you're gone. So I went through three treatment centers in the Navy, and I had like 12 years invested, and I went down to I was getting out, 12 years, I'm done, I don't want this anymore. So I got out of the personnel office, and I said, where's my discharge papers? Today's the day, I'm out of here. So they looked through my record, and they says, no, you got six more years. And I said, what? So yeah, you got six more years, and they showed me this picture of me standing there with this black ensign, re-upping, in a blackout. And I also had a notation in my record that says, one more alcohol-related incident, and you will be dishonorably discharged. One more. And it was an open page 13, if you know anything about military records, which meant any commissioned officer could sign his name to it and I'd be gone. And I thought, I can't do that. You know, I don't want to go home without a future. So I said, I know what I'll do. I'll come to AA, and I won't drink, and I won't drug for 8 years. And then when they hand me the paper, I can drink like a gentleman. That was my thought. So I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to get sober. I didn't come here to find God. I didn't come here to do any of this. None of it. I just came in here to mark time. So when I got here, I'm sitting in a meeting, and it's very boring. There's no action. Everybody's talking about weird stuff that I've never encountered before, like discipline and like don't drink one day at a time and, you know, all that clicky stuff that you guys say when you first walk in the door and you look at it and say... So they told me that I needed to not go to this meeting, because this house meeting, because there were nothing but weirdos there. And I got the address. So I walked into this house meeting, and there were two gay ladies sitting on a couch. There was a guy, Arthur, he was a gay guy, sitting in a rattan chair. There was a woman sitting on the floor who was so huge that all she could wear was sheets. There was Larry that talked about his car every meeting. I swear, I think he had a love affair going with his Chrysler New Yorker, because no matter what the topic was, he would tell you what he did to his car this week. It's higher power. And the guy that brought me to the meeting off the same ship I was on was a transvestite, and he had gone upstairs and changed. So I'm sitting in this meeting feeling very comfortable. I thought, I'm not as sick as these people. And I thought, if they can stay sober with their condition, you know. So I made it my home group because I felt superior to them. I felt like I really had my stuff together. And we had a 50-year home group reunion about 2 years ago, and everybody that was in our room is still sober, by the way. Which means that no matter what your condition, you can get sober and stay sober, no matter what your condition. It was called the Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Traveling Group. Loved it. But they told me not to make any major decisions for a year. One of the rules, unwritten rules in AA. Don't make any major decisions. So I didn't do the third step. That's pretty major. Instead, I waited until I was 366 days sober to get married. No major decisions in the first year. And I made this woman my higher power. She was an AA. She had 2 years. I had one. You know, it's like she was seven, I was five. Stumbling through life, trying to figure it out. And we were like the AA couple, you know, pull into the driveway, open the trunk, put on my AA suit, come in and expound all my knowledge and wisdom, go outside, put the AA suit back in the trunk, and go home and think about suicide. I wasn't very good in relationships. Still not. I stayed in the Navy until I had my time in to retire. That was 5 years sober, getting ready to retire. And I was out on a 90-day shakedown cruise on the ship I was on, and when I got back, we were going to sign my papers and I would be done. Well, my wife had fallen in love with another woman while I was gone. And I don't know about you guys, but there's no competing. You know, I can't beat the shit out of her. I can't shoot her. I can't, you know. And 5 years sober, and I took my 38 pistol, and I figured I would go to this meeting where they go to and meet them and finish it all. I was in so much pain. And they happened to be at a women's retreat down in Nag's Head that weekend, and I didn't know, and I'm doing drive-bys by their houses and looking for them and trying to find them. I was crazy. And I went to this meeting, and I'm standing outside this meeting, Tanglewood meeting in Virginia Beach, and my so-called sponsor came walking by, and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm waiting for Ellen and Kathy to show up." He said, "Why?" I said, "I'm going to kill them." He said, "With what?" And I said, "With my 38, and I showed him my gun. Cut the tension with a knife. He says, "Maybe you should let me hold on to that until after the meeting, you know, and give you some time to think." I said, "Okay." Well, I gave him the gun and put it in his trunk. Then he's thinking, and he says, "Well, if they show up and they go to the meeting, you know, and he's in there, it's going to cause a great disturbance." He said, "Why don't you go to this other meeting? It might help you." It's my first Al-Anon meeting. And then they're talking about detaching with love, and I go, "I got some love for you." So meeting ended, they didn't show up. My sponsor gave me my gun back on the promise that I would go home and go to bed and put the gun away. So I was so crazy, so absolutely insane, that I went over to the Portsmouth Naval Hospital at 6 o'clock in the morning. I leaned up against the wall outside of the psychiatric unit, had my foot on the wall. Navy shrink came walking in, looked at me, went in, dropped his hat and his coat off, came back out, put his foot up on the wall, looked at me and says, "What's up?" So I'm going to kill him. He said, "Who?" "My wife and her girlfriend." And he says, "With what?" I showed him my gun. It seemed common. That seemed like the thing to do. I mean, if you've never been insane, you don't know. Say, you don't know, but I mean. So he took me into his office, you know, and he said, "It'd be nice if you just stuck that gun outside the door, because there's some people out there that are kind of worried about you having that with me in here." And I said, "Okay." So I stuck the gun out the door, and they took it away. Make a long story short, I wound up sitting in, they put me in a padded cell because I was crazy. And straitjacket, a padded cell, 5 years sober. I knew everything. And I'm sitting in this padded cell, wrapped up in this jacket like this. You know, and I'm looking out the window in the shrink ward, you know, and I got that little observation window like that, not that big, and I'm looking out there going, "Man, there's a lot of crazy bastards out there." Now you're in a fruitcake. So they let my sponsor came to see me, Gene Gorman. I picked Gene Gorman as a sponsor. He had 6 more months sobriety than I did. But he would come to meetings in combat gear, and then he'd go to a meeting, and then he would pull his hoodie down over his face with the eyes cut in. You know, he was an ex-Marine, and he was a peeping Tom. And then after the meeting, he'd be a peeping Tom, and he'd come back and not drink, and I'd go, "Perfect. What I want." But he came to see me, and I'm sitting in this rubber room in a straitjacket, and he says, "Do you want to die?" And I said, "They're not going to let me." He said, "Do you want to live?" And I said, "Not really." He said, "Well, that's good." And I said, "What do you mean, good?" He says, "Now, maybe you'll give some consideration to turning your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand Him." Third step. No major decisions. And I said to this guy, first time I'd ever broke down, I said, "I don't know what that requires. I don't know what that means. What is my will? What is my life? I don't know. I'm in a fog here, and I don't have a God, so." And he says, "Change the will and the life to your thoughts and your actions." And he said, "If you don't have a God, you can use mine until you find yours." So I got down on my knees in a straitjacket in a rubber room, and he got down on his knees, and I did the third step prayer, and I turned my will and life over to the care of God as I understood Him. And what happened is I slept 23 hours. First time I'd slept in weeks. I slept. I went through this training program, this treatment program with this psychiatrist, and then I retired out of the Navy, and he wanted me to go to see a therapist. And I'd always had problems with strong, aggressive women. And he says, I want you to go see this female therapist. Her name was Bernadette Jones. And I was in therapy for 3 years with four other executive women. And at the beginning of it, they shredded me. And then at the end of it, we were friends. And I learned how to be friends with people. Because I never could. You know, I always told you what I thought you wanted to hear. I acted the way I thought you wanted me to act. There was nothing ever real with me. I was like a chameleon. I'd come into AA and watch how you guys talked and watch how you guys acted, and I'd hang back, and then I'd start laughing like you did and talking like you did, and I learned the book and I learned the slogans, and I put on a damn good show because I didn't want to leave. So I stayed in AA. After 5 years of sobriety, I finally started working the steps. I don't recommend this to anybody. You know, I mean, I just got the grace of God put me in the right people with the right people, you know, and kept me sober long enough until I could find out what was here, what was being offered. I didn't know. When they say, if you want what we have, I'm going, well, what do you have? You know, I saw the Cadillac in the parking lot. I want that. Who's got that? You know, I never knew what was being offered. So I didn't want to come home to Florida, so when I retired, I picked up this newcomer who needed transportation up to Olney, Maryland, and I got one move from the Navy, so I tagged up with her and moved all her shit up there, and lived with her for a while, and discovered Olney, Maryland. I had to get a job. They had shift work downtown D.C. at a place called Chemtrek, Chemical Manufacturers Emergency Transportation Network. It's an 800 number on every bottle of stuff you got in your house. You know, like the baby drinks the bleach, or a car falls over, or, you know, you have an ammonia spill, or yada, yada, yada. You call this number, and they had a computer bank full of remedies, you know, drink copious amounts of water, or medical attention and all that. So I spent 6 weeks training on this thing, and I'm thinking, this is a perfect job for me. Shift work, real easy. All I got to do is just look it up on the phone and tell them what to do. I took the graveyard shift because it was the quietest. So all by myself up in this big building downtown D.C., midnight, my very first phone call alone by myself doing this shift was from Bhopal, India. The isocyanate plant blew up and there was a cloud of chlorine gas moving, and for the next 23 hours I listened to people scream and die. They couldn't stop it. I mean, they'd try to hide in their cars, they tried to hide in their basements, they tried to hide everywhere, and this stuff was just a huge cloud of 100% chlorine gas that was just eating everything in its path. So after that, I quit. I thought, I've already had the high points. So I quit working for them. They asked me if it was about the money, and I said, no, it's not about the money. It's about the job. I can't do this. About the time I quit, my mother and my sister showed up at my doorstep and said, your grandmother's dying and we're going to have a reunion for her and she wants you to come. So I went to Boston, Massachusetts. And up until this time, if you'd asked me who my family was, I'd have told you that they were all alcoholics, drug addicts, and they weren't worth a shit. So I went to this family reunion. I had an uncle who was the president of the airlines union. I had another uncle who had like 18 lobster boats. He had a fleet of lobsters. You know. So I'm walking around this reunion, and all these people are saying hello to me, and I don't recognize any of them. Because like so many alcoholics, I didn't come into being until I was 10. I have no clue about any of that other stuff. And I had this hole in my stomach, and I'm walking around trying to figure out how they know me. Oh, and people my age are coming up to me saying, don't you remember when we used to do this in toboggan and we used to play in the summertime and go swimming? I knew. I don't remember any of that. I was so self-absorbed when I was growing up, so fearful. My grandmother wanted to see a 8mm film of me when I was 6. And she said it was the most embarrassing moment in her life. I was dressed up like a wise man for Christmas. And I was supposed to bend over and pick up this baby doll that was supposed to represent the baby Jesus. Well, I bent over and I picked it up backwards. Instead of the head being up here, the head was down here. And when I picked it up, the damn thing slid out of the blankets and fell on the stage. And I didn't know what to do. I'm 6. So my father was in the front row, so I kicked it. Kicked the doll to him. And of course, everybody in the room freaked out laughing and having a going on. I don't remember that. So I was pretty funny even when I was young. But since I've been sober, it's taken me a very, very long, long time to get the requirements of not only sobriety, but happy, useful living. I was so afraid, had so many. We all have the same 5 fears walking in the door. There's 5 of them: fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of abandonment, fear of confrontation, and fear of intimacy. 5 of them. And they ruled my life. Absolutely ruled my life for the first 20 years of my sobriety. I didn't understand. I came from a family that was disassociative with everybody. Like, they kept everybody away from us, and it was just what I learned from them. So I learned very good manners from my father, and I learned hypervigilance from my family. Hypervigilance is when you can tell when they come home how they walk in the door, whether they're drunk or not, and you have to hide. That's hypervigilance. That when you hear them in bed snoring and you hear that particular snore, you know he's about to wake up and you hide. That's hypervigilance. That's what I learned. It served me well today. But the girl that I married, Ellen, well, I got a divorce and she hooked up with Kathy. And this is how Alcoholics Anonymous works. I was so hurt by the betrayal. And I didn't know who to talk to, and I had no friends because we were all cliquish. So I'm sitting in my apartment dying. And Kathy, the girl my wife fell in love with, called me. She was in the program too. She had 5 years. And she said, you don't have to go through this alone, and if you want to, you can come over here and stay with us. And I went, okay. And I thought, I don't think so. I mean, the offer was there. I mean, she actually extended her hand and said, your drinking is more important than the 3 of us combined, so if you need some place to come to where you can be safe, come here. And I didn't. I wanted to go to my sponsor instead, but the offer was there. You know what I mean? You know what that takes to do that? To have my interest at heart rather than theirs? Oh, my God. And we're still best friends. Kathy's long gone. Ellen lives up in Virginia Beach. We talk to each other. We still got that friendship back that we had before we screwed it up with marriage. And since I've been sober, I've probably had about 200 different jobs. Sales jobs, mostly. I like jobs where you can be a chameleon. You know, where I can walk out the door and put on this face for you and show you what I offer and then turn it off just like that. And then come to Alcoholics Anonymous and turn on the AA face. I mean, I had so many... That's not necessary. I had so many masks that I wore. You know, I had an AA mask. I had a mass for my mother, I had a mass for my girlfriend, I had a mass for my boss, you know, and I could never, ever be me. Never. And my sponsor was dead on the money when he said, most people take 5 years to get walking around, since it's probably going to take you about 20. And it took me 20. All I can tell you is that the most important thing for me today is I don't drink, no matter what. I mean, I've been through the mill. See? The way you get 34, 35 years of sobriety is you don't drink if your ass falls off. You find another way to sit. I'm telling you. I mean, I don't want to harp on this too much, but there's a room full of people in here, and I've got 35 years of sobriety. And how many people in this room have 35 years of sobriety? Why is that? We give out so many white chips, we should be top-heavy. We should have a lot of people with long-term sobriety, but we don't. Because the attrition rate in here is so horrible. People come in here and take a hard look and then turn around and walk out and die. This is terminal. And once you come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that Pete? Is that your name? The new guy?
Mark.
Mark. Once you come to a meeting and you raise your hand and say you're an alcoholic, you're screwed. Because that's a decision you can't take away. So you got a choice. You're either going to get locked up, you're going to get covered up, or you're going to get sobered up. And how I stayed sober as long as I have, it's a miracle. You know, I didn't drink even when I wanted to drink. When I knew that drinking would ease the pain, I didn't drink. And I did something different. I was told when I got here, fear, fellowship, and a high sugar diet will keep you sober for a while. Whatever it takes. And when they pass out these numbers for you to use them. You know, even if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I remember calling my sponsor at 2 o'clock in the morning and talking to him when I was thinking about suicide again. That was a recurring theme in my first 20 years, you know. I don't want to be here anymore. I used to walk by an empty parking lot and think that the spaceship would come down and take me home. I didn't think I came from here, you know. People raise their hand, where are you from? I'd be like, well, Pluto. That's good. I'm off world. I don't belong here. But I kept hanging around and kept coming back and kept coming back and kept coming back. I did a 4-step when I was about 7 years sober. The one that I did before that was I took their inventory. Okay? And I found out why I was so screwed up. It's their fault. So my first attempt at making a 9-step, I went home to my mother and she's got like 38 years sober. I went home to my mother and I said, I'm sorry. She said, we know that. Not the response I wanted. So, the exact nature. Not that I lied and I cheated and I stole and I'm an asshole. Let's talk about the who, the what, the when, the where, and the why. And I had to do that in detail, in very, very deep detail, in inventory work. And that was, I think it was a long book. You know, I had to look at everything inside of me. Why do I do the things that I do? Why am I so ashamed of my life? Why am I so afraid of my life? Why? And I would walk through the meetings of AA. I've been to every international convention since then, except for this last one. You know, and I can tell you that the one thing that has saved my ass time and time again is that I became a seeker. When I got here, after 5 years of sobriety, I had a woman called Flo Bird Johnson who said, "You will not drink if you stay a seeker." So, being in the Navy, I got a chance to travel. I went to the pyramids of Egypt, and I got to look at them. I went to Stonehenge. I went to the Sistine Chapel. I went to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I walked on the Great Wall of China. I went to a Buddhist temple. I went to the Aztecs down in Mexico. I became a member of the Fellowship of the Inner Light. I'm a card-carrying member of the Edgar Casey Foundation. You know, looking. What is it? What is it? And what I found was in me. See? And what's in me is the God in me. I found that over here at a Unity Church. After all that traveling, I found it. And it says in a book, the great reality lives deep within, and it's usually the last place we look. So the God in me greets the God in you. And I want to read you something, and then I'm going to shut up. This is an old paper. It's over 40 years old. It's from my group, my Beachcomber Spiritual Progress Traveling Group. And this is what we believe. It says, what is AA? AA is a spirit. It cannot be touched, nor can it be completely understood. It's as wide as the world, yet small enough to fit snugly into the mind and hearts of man. It has brought light where only darkness dwelt. It has given hope to the helpless and help to those who yearned in despair. It has nourished forgiveness in those who knew no pity. It has given strength to the weak and humility to the strong. It has given greatness to the common. It has spurred to higher goals those who strove for nothing. It has transformed sorrow into a weapon of weakness. It has given purpose to the trackless and shelter to the lost. It has taught patience to the hurried and action to the slothful. To youth, it has given vision. To the aged, promise. To the lonely, companions. And to the restless, rest. To the sick, it has been a doctor, and to the dying, it has revived the desire to live. To those who have fallen, it has been a helping hand. It has no judgment against the unteachable, nor has it praise for those who learn. To the outcast, it has been a family, and to the childless, it has given children. To the ignorant, wisdom, and to the wise, tolerance. It has given to all men that which is most precious. It has given love for truth with enough left over to share with each other. Thank you.